Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Hello and welcome everyone to the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor podcast. It's great to have your company again. It's also great to have the company of my two great co-hosts, Kate Bakos and Dave Johnston. Kate, I'm very keen to hear how auctions went on the weekend, because that gives us a little bit of a litmus test as to what's happening in particular in Melbourne. So how'd you go?
Interesting thing to report to both of you. As it turns out, my four auctions turned into three, and I had two that I won, and they were great. They were still contested. I was up against an advocate on one and up against a passionate duo who wanted to secure their first home for another. But the one that I missed out on was in Brunswick East, which is like the new Fitzroy North. It's one of Melbourne's trendy inner northern suburbs. And I was up against a lot of people, and there were parents in the crowd too. That's always a scary sign. And we didn't secure that. It was very, very competitive. And you wouldn't have known that we've had an interest rate increase or a looming federal election or anything that could potentially destabilise the market. I felt like I was bidding back in September 2021.
Gee whiz. All right. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next few weeks, months. Like, obviously, we've got the election. Well, by the time this goes to air, the election would have come and gone. But, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how we move on after the election. Both political parties have some very interesting housing policies. One's talking about accessing your super and also incentivising the boomers to downsize by putting some extra into their super. And the Labor Party has their shared equity scheme. So it'll be interesting to see who gets in.
Well, you haven't talked about Clive Palmer. He's going to decrease interest rates.
Oh, my God.
I can't wait.
Guaranteed. Not to go above 3%.
Is that right, mate? How are you going to do that? How are you going to do that? You're going to force the retail banks to keep their interest rates low, are you? Good luck with that.
That's just too whimsical. If only it wasn't really happening.
Yeah, that's right. Unfortunately, some people are believing it. Yeah.
Probably happily dragged the whole economy down the toilet just to achieve it.
Yeah. Dave, how are you going?
Yeah, all good, Pete. Enjoying life being back to normal. I was chatting to one of the dads at a pickup on Friday, and he was saying for our boys who are in grade two, it's been the longest continuous stretch of school they've ever had. Because obviously,
For over 2 years, of course.
So,
I had an interesting observation. My daughter came home saying, "Oh, you know, this group is now this, and these girls have been outed, and now, you know, I've made friends with these two, and they're all like they're in year 10, of course. These girls are all shuffling around their friendships and working out their pecking order and all the stuff that, you know, girls often do in year 8 and year 9." And Ian said to me, "Don't you reckon it's a bit late for this?" I said, "Well, yes, but they've been in lockdown for 2 years. We haven't had any of this social pecking order. You know, it's all new for a lot of kids, and it just goes to show how far and wide all of this social readjustment can go."
Very true. Yeah.
Before we get into today's episode, take a listen to our weekly market update.
Dave, you got a market update for us?
Just about rents, and, you know, if we look at the last 12 months, Brisbane rents have increased by 20.9%, Adelaide 19.8%, Sydney 19.4%, right down to Melbourne 9.4% across the board, and they're continuing to outpace the rate of capital growth. So we're in a period where rental returns are going to continue to increase and start to get back to what historically they used to be. And it's one of the things to remember for people that if you have outperforming capital growth properties, the rental yields tend to keep up. You know, they can't keep reducing forever. At the point of purchase, even if your rental yield may be lower, if you've got a high capital growth performing asset, it's likely your rental growth as opposed to yield will be an outperformer over the long run. You know, it's just one of those things to remember. It's not about necessarily about what the yield is when you purchase, but what is the rent likely to grow by over the long term? So, you know, we're about to come into a space already into it where rental returns are outpacing capital growth, and we haven't had a lot of that for quite a period of time. So I think it's just an opportunity for our listeners to watch, learn, see what happens, see how things change, because it isn't an experience that many have been through probably, because it hasn't been that way for quite some time.
Excellent. Thanks for that, Dave. Kate?
Well, I was asked this question so much over the last 10, 11 days, I decided to write a blog to address it so that I could forward it to people and share my insights. Now, I was prompted to write the blog because I saw an article in the paper over the course of last week that was correlating rising interest rates with falling house prices, and I didn't necessarily agree with it. In fact, we've talked about this together before, and Pete, one of your assessments was really the impetus for me writing this. And what I did was looked at all of the housing price falls over the last few decades and had a look at where the interest rate movement was at the time. So were rates trending upwards or down? And what it really clearly demonstrated was there wasn't a correlation between increasing cash rate and decreasing house prices. Even going back further into past decades, it was completely obvious that there wasn't a correlation. In fact, sometimes it was the inverse of the point that was being made by this journalist. So what I wanted people to be aware of is that there's more to property growth than interest rate movement, and they're generally not so related. And I think we've got to take a step back and look at what we're doing over the long term.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot that goes into moving prices either up or down in the property market. It's not just one thing. But one conclusion that I've come to is government policy has a huge impact on property booms. May not have a huge impact on property during the whole cycle, but, you know, the stimulus that they bring in with first-time buyer incentives, home builder, that sort of thing, capital gains tax discounts, it's just phenomenal what it can do. And then we spend two and a half years playing catch-up. Just before we get into our episode today, I'd just like to congratulate Perth on finally reaching a record price there. It's only taken them 8 years to have property prices higher than they were, and it's taken a huge two-year boom to get there. Yeah, it's good to see that Perth is moving in the right direction, in particular for all of those owner occupiers and investors who've been probably wallowing in, some of them maybe in negative equity for a while. You know, the great times were back in 2006, so here we are 16 years later, and it's better, but hopefully things continue to get better for them, especially now that they've relaxed their COVID restrictions.
For the first time in 8 years, the average value, the median value of property in Perth is above what it was 8 years ago.
Correct. Normally it takes 10 years for property prices to double. Poor old Perth. Took them 8 years just to get back to where they were. Poor buggers.
We love hearing from our listeners, and we'd love to tackle more of your questions. So please, if you have any on your mind, no matter how great or small, send us a message. You can email us info@propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor, or go to our website, Facebook page, or simply click on the link in your podcast app under the play button and fill out our online form.
This episode, we've got a number of listener questions. So we try and make it as generic as possible, because these would relate to many people. Have a listen to the background, because the background may not be exactly like yours, but the general theme, I think, would be for many people. So the first one is from Adrian, and basically the question's about investing in property before or after starting a family. So Adrian starts, "Hey guys, love the show. My partner and I are in our late 20s, work full-time and plan on starting a family in the next 3 to 4 years. We bought our first home in 2019 in a suburb called Woodcroft in Adelaide, which we plan on staying in long-term. Since then, with extra repayments in the market, we've built up equity of $200,000. As our incomes will be changing with time off for kids, what advice would you have when weighing up the pros and cons of investing now compared with waiting until our incomes are more steady, that is, kids have started school, back to work, and we've paid off more of our mortgage? So really, it boils down to investing in property during or after starting a family and investing in property or paying off the home mortgage first. Dave, you want to kick us off there, or did you need some more detail?
No, that's all good. I've had a bit of a look at it. It's a really good question from Adrian, and it's a really difficult one to answer, and I think it, you know, it's unique for each individual. We actually wrote a property plan for some clients not too long ago who were in this situation, and it was really building out the scenarios of what it would look like, among other things, if they bought prior to having kids, waited, what buffers do they need in place. For Adrian, go through the numbers. Their house is worth $650,000. 80% of that is $520,000. So the current loan balance is about, call it $280,000. They've got $40,000 buffer in redraw, $320,000 limit, therefore, on the loan. So they have accessible equity of $200,000. Their current income is $172,000. If we look at what could they purchase an investment property for without having to pay mortgage insurance, which is usually a pretty good sort of parameter to put in place as a starting point when you're looking at someone buying their first investment property. Now, some people will be happy to go into mortgage insurance and some people it'll make sense to. For these guys, they could purchase a property for around $600,000, and their current borrowing capacity certainly allows for that. So that would mean they'd have $1.25 million of property. 80% equity would be $1 million. So that means if their existing limit is $320,000, they could set up an investment facility for $680,000. Purchasing that $600,000 property, they'd have a balance of $630,000. And I think quite importantly, it would allow to have another $50,000 buffer of redraw there. So the gut feel and just working off an 80% rounded number is, and well within their current borrowing capacity, a price point that feels about right for them is about $500,000 to $600,000. But obviously, that's just based off their current situation, yet to get into factoring in when they start the family. So if we look at the cash flow for them, which is obviously a vital consideration, assume rent at 3.5% is probably slightly conservative, but, you know, properties are unlikely to be rented out all the time. So it's okay to be, it should always be conservative with the numbers. Rent at $1,837 per month. Assume repayments paying interest only on the investment loan at 4%, so that's $2,100 per month. Holding costs will say about 1%, so that comes down to $500 per month. So they've got a shortfall of $800 per month. Now, if you factor in tax deductions, it's about $550 per month. So first things first, I would say to Adrian and his wife, okay, firstly, you know, can he obviously afford that today? But then how would that play out when you're down to one income or one and a half incomes? So we're talking about 2 years off work for Adrian's talking about for his partner, and then she'd be back to 3 days. So their current income's about $170,000. It would reduce down to about $100,000 for a couple of years. And then it would be up to $135,000 when she comes back for 3 days per week. So one of the things you need to consider is what's the right buffer to have in place. So in my scenario, I've given them $90,000, okay, on gross debt of around $900,000. So about 10%, which is not a bad sort of number to land on often for people, but you've got to decide what's right for you. I mean, ultimately, it comes down to your cash flow, your buffer, and very importantly, your risk profile, because you need to work out, okay, what today is our living expenses? What are they likely to be after we've had our first child? You know, obviously, what's our income going to reduce by? And probably the big one is how comfortable will we be? We're going through having a kid, our, you know, second child, and if we're flat or even going backwards, in terms of cash flow for a couple of years or a few years. That's the really tricky one, because it really goes to your risk tolerance. And obviously another big thing to factor in is the opportunity cost. So if you just work out, you know, what if you bought today and let's say you get in 5 to 7 years in advance, compound growth, let's say 5%, but you can play 7%, 3%. What's the opportunity cost you're going to miss out on by not purchasing for another 5 to 7 years, really, versus the peace of mind of knowing you don't have that commitment or debt and maybe you have flat or even slightly negative cash flow, ensuring you've got a significant buffer in place, and worst case scenario, you can always sell the investment property and you'll be back to scratch or maybe a little bit behind. That's really what you need to work through, because, you know, assume you come out the other side. So much of it comes down to that period, which for most people, it's hard to plan for, and most people don't properly prepare for the fact that their cash flow is likely to be neutral or may even go backwards during the period of having kids. And that period can last, you know, with the cost of childcare and, you know, what have you, that period can last for many years. And I think, you know, from my experience working obviously with people for over 20 years, people don't generally adequately prepare for that, and it impacts different people in different ways. So I think that's really what Adrian needs to work through, you know. And so then really comes down to risk profile, because I think it's achievable. Whether the price point is, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, they could even go 7 or 8 and go into mortgage insurance territory. This is the thing that you've got to work out. And that's where we frame it with the property plans around what we call their money goals, because their money goals is really what we're comfortable with having in the bank at any given time. And that's unique to each individual.
Thanks for that, Dave. Kate, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I love this listener question. And that consideration of weighing up capital growth starting earlier versus spending more later and getting a better asset later, that's always a consideration when someone's talking about augmenting their property journey by having, you know, kids at some stage in the middle. And these guys are pretty young, so I read through the notes to get a real feel for whether I'd be saying go hard now while you're young and get some assets in the portfolio and let them do the heavy lifting while you back things off. But as Dave said, cash flow is integral, because the last thing you want your family to do is work around the property. You want your property to work around your family, always. And then I had a look at the metrics that Adrian shared. And while he's got some really good, clear goals, he's not being greedy at all. And he's got some really sound goals that he's aiming for that are very achievable. And they're young. These guys are in their late 20s. The first thing that struck me is a really good goal to aim for and something not to panic about is he'd be happy retiring somewhere between 55 and 60 on a $60,000 income from property. So let's say he's got a buy and hold strategy, he might pay those properties down and that income is coming in as rent. So that's very achievable in my view when you're this young. So how could he go about that? Well, we can look at growing some equity by getting a high growth performing asset early, or we can look at working out how he could buy more lower priced properties that are yielding a stronger rental yield. And the reason I say that that's something viable is he's not looking at upgrading the family home necessarily. In one of his paragraphs, he said a house is 5 bedrooms, so it's enough room for 2 kids. We wouldn't necessarily need to move. We can't predict whether we'd be happy there for 30 plus years, but you know, right now it's adequate. So that says to me there's no burning need to upgrade. And he's living in Adelaide. He's really happy there. So I think that we need to have a look at this sensibly in terms of maybe not necessarily 3 properties. It might be 4 or 5 properties that are lower price point properties that are delivering a stronger rental yield. And that might allow his acquisition strategy to continue while they've got children, because they won't need high incomes to service a strong out-of-pocket if they've got yielding properties. That was just my insight. But I think they've got all kinds of opportunities depending on how their risk profile sits. But I think these are very achievable goals and he's getting onto it very early.
I think they have a very good basis there. If Adrian and his partner were keen to invest in Adelaide, I'd suggest For that, for the 600 that Dave mentioned, probably go buy yourself a house around Christie's Beach, Port Nalunga South, which is not far from Woodcroft. Woodcroft may be a lovely area to raise a family, but it doesn't have the capital growth potential, I think, that those seaside suburbs do. So to be able to have something with some good capital growth growing in value while your kids are growing as well will put you in a very good position in several years' time. And then if you want to, if that helps you achieve your goals, you can go again and maybe again. Because the only way you're going to go again is either you save more money or you increase the value of your property or your properties. Thanks very much for that, Adrian. Any last comments there before we move on to Dean's question?
Just with the family home, yeah, it's a really good point, Kate, and something we talk a lot about. And he said potentially they might upgrade one day for $1.2 million, just putting a number out there. But I think if they do stay, and we always talk to clients about this, if they do stay in their current home for the long term, it makes it so much easier for them to build an investment portfolio and achieve their financial goals. So subject to what their priorities are, you know, if this is their one and only home, that's fantastic in terms of achieving, you know, being able to invest and not have buying and selling getting in the way of your investment strategy and achieving that $60,000 rental income goal.
Okay. So, Dean, investing in property without a planner. Well, I don't think you're on your lonesome there, Dean. Hi there. I made a mistake when I began my investing journey in that I did little to no research, had no idea about investing, yet decided to jump in head first and buy a couple of properties. I soon learned that there was a touch more to it than just putting your name on a title. I think there might be a lot more than just a touch more, Dean, but we'll get into that very shortly. I'm wondering if this is a common occurrence in your experience. Yes, it is certainly in my experience, where people jump into an investment without really having a strategy at all. So basically, Dean bought a unit in Iluka and Dean bought another unit in Tweed Heads. And he says, while they haven't been a disaster, they had no strategy behind them, and I'm wondering if they can make a good fit for the portfolio or if it's better to move them on and target something that's more suited. So basically the question is, how do you recover from early purchases like this where there is little to no strategy and possibly little to no capital growth? Does one need to recover, or which means sell and move on, or do you just hang on and wait? Dave, I'll get you to kickstart.
I love Dean's approach and, yeah, his matter-of-factness. He also said, I gather there'd be a host of more information that would be needed before any conclusions could be made. Please let me know if you'd like any more and what information I should provide. I enjoy your podcast and really appreciate the content you put out. Thank you. For such a young person, they're great questions. You know, he's tried to get ahead early on and, yeah, that's half the battle. He's bought two investment properties and we've asked a few more questions and had a bit of a look at them. So the Iluka property over 5 years has had compound growth of about 6%, so that's pretty solid. The Tweed Heads one has had compound growth of about 3%. And then the rental returns are both quite high, so Iluka's about 5% and Tweed's about 6%. They've both done okay. I guess Tweed hasn't had much of a capital growth return. Now, we've been able to look at the properties themselves. The Iluka property isn't much, but it is on a reasonable plot of land. The dwelling itself is pretty flimsy and pretty basic. And then Tweed Heads, we haven't been able to analyse the street and the pocket. Both locations have a level of scarcity. You know, they're by the ocean. They look okay. I think the big questions would be what comes next for them. I think the question is, would be when do they plan to buy a home and what does it look like? What's the price range? And really, you know, would that home be a stepping stone home or a long-term home? Because that's ultimately going to decide whether these two rental properties can be held or not. Looking at whether they're already positively geared, There's certainly much less of a case to sell an investment property once it becomes positively geared. So that would be a factor. So they are some of the considerations. Look, there's no doubt having a plan in advance and understanding what drives out performance makes a difference, but half the battle is just getting out there and doing something. The vast majority of people retire owning one property or no properties. You've already got two, Dean, so well done, mate. You're ahead of most people your age. And in fact, you know, if you just add on to these two for the rest of your life and paid them off, you'd be well ahead of the vast majority of people in retirement. Kate, what are your thoughts?
I love Dean's honesty and willingness to put himself out there. And Dean, I've got three things that I think are awesome that you've done, and I want to point them out so that you're not feeling terrible. I can see that you felt you overpaid for Tweed and you're disappointed with your lack of due diligence. And the three things that you've got going for you, first and foremost, if this was a cash flow strategy, you've come close to nailing it because you're almost cash flow neutral, and in time you'll be positive. It won't be long at all. So these will be set and forgets. And what I will say about properties that we're not so happy with is unless they're total duds, it's a very forgiving asset class and you're so young, you've got a long amount of time in front of you to forgive these. And if they're a bit speculative, if you're hoping for both of these locations to do something, well, it's not an expensive gamble in my view now that you're sitting on something that's almost neutral. The next thing that I'll say is working well for you is you're living with parents. So your capacity to save and you've got great incomes is really strong. And last of all, you've spoken about just how much you've learned through this. And I think in the scheme of things, when mistakes that we make or acquisitions that we can identify some mistakes within, when we learn something from them, sometimes it's a really big ticket learning. It's a very expensive mistake. For you, you've got so much learning out of this. So what I want to say is you've got the potential to grow some equity here. You've got two properties that really aren't costing you too much to hold. You're young and your incomes are good. And let's start the planned part of your property journey now. You've got a lot of time in front of you. I think you've got an amazing outlook and this has been a great education for you so far.
Yeah, look, I was happy to see that he hadn't bought two off-the-plan apartments or two brand-new apartments which had gone backwards in value. However, yes, you know, we're all geniuses in hindsight and maybe, he should have got some expert advice or got a property plan organised. But as I'm one of those blokes that can do two things at a time, while Dave was chatting, I checked to see the performance of regional New South Wales over the last 5 years. So he said one of his properties, Anne-Marie worked out, it compounded at 6% over 5 years, which, I mean, I can't do the maths in my head, but it's probably around a total of 40% increase, which is pretty good. The other property at 3% compounding, which is about 20%. So basically we got one property increase at 40%, another property increase at 20%. However, regional New South Wales increased 80% in that five-year period. So look, it's not bad. It could have been better. It's not bad. As Kate was saying, if it's a cash flow strategy, you've almost nailed it. But I think it's important to work out what your goals are and then to find those properties that'll suit those goals, whether it's capital growth, whether it's rental return. But thankfully, there has been some growth. Could have been better, but it's not all bad news. Any final comments there, Kate or Dave?
Yeah, I think these two need to have a look at their capacity to save, so their surplus incomes. They're pulling down some good money and they're young. The next thing they need to think about is how they anticipate the growth trajectory of their incomes. Where are their careers taking them? Are they in roles that will exhibit increases in salary over time? What sort of contribution could they make out of their surplus cash flow to really put into their property investing part of their journey? And then what sort of home purchase do they want and how do they start provisioning for that? Because with a bit of advice, they'll be able to work out whether their next project is focusing on the home or whether they're still happy to do what they're doing and continue building the portfolio. If they do opt for that, that's really a rent vesting strategy. The only words of advice I'd have is be committed to the properties that you pop into your rent vesting portfolio, because the only time I see rent vesting fail is when people don't anticipate how they'll feel about buying a family home, and then they're having to sell off good properties to get into their home because they've not understood where their emotional journey will take them. So that's my biggest word of warning, but you guys are young, you've got time in front of you. I absolutely think you can nail $100,000 passive income upon retirement with some good planning.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
Our last listener question is directed towards me, basically capital growth calculations and suburb growth rate. Hi, Pete, I'm really sorry to bug you. I just had a growth calculation query and was hoping you may be able to assist me, please. Is there a way to calculate the 3-month, 6-month, 1-year and 2-year growth of a suburb using Excel? I know you can probably Google the growth rate of a suburb, but I'm keen to work it all out, which is great that you want to work it out to get down to the nitty gritty. Basically, these calculations are just percentage calculations. So, for example, you find the median price of all the sold properties in the first period, whether your period is a quarter, 6 months, a year, whatever it might be, right? Find the median price. And let's call that period A. Then you find the median price of sold properties in the second period, period B. Then, and we'll put this up in the show notes, it's bracket, period B, take period A, bracket, divided by A equals the change in price. So if I can give you an example, if in the first quarter of 2021, property sold for 500, median price of property sold was 500. And then in the first quarter of 2022, median price of sold properties was 600, right? There's $100,000 difference. So it's 600, period B, take away 500, period A equals 100, right? Then it's 100 divided by period A, which is 500. And 100 divided by 500 is 20%. So the property values went up 20%. But please be very, very careful because figures can be very skewed if you're using short periods of time because you don't have many data points. Let me give you an example. Let's change the comparison from houses to fruit. All right. So what you're saying is, what was the median price of fruit in the first quarter of last year and the median price of fruit in the first quarter of this year? Well, in a quarter compared to a year, you're not going to sell that many fruit. And you might have had apples and oranges and bananas and kiwi fruit and avocado all sell in the first quarter and same in the second quarter. So it's very hard to say what was the price of fruit. But if by some chance they all happened to be bananas last year that were sold and they were all bananas this year, then that's a true comparison. It's like saying in this suburb, all the houses are built in the 1980s and they're all 3 bedrooms and 1 bathroom. And all you might need is a handful of those suburbs to come up with a very confident answer as to how much property prices have increased. But you might have 20 sales. 3 of them, the houses were built in the 60s and they're 2-bedroom. 6 of them are period-style homes. 5 of them are brand-new townhouses. Well, it's very hard to make the comparison. But one thing that you can do to try and make your data more reliable is lengthen the period of time. I would be very reticent to try and work out the difference based on a quarter. I would generally go annually. If you try and compare what happened last year to this year, you're going to have more data points and the data is going to be more reliable. Kate, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, you've made a very good point about median house prices, Pete, because lots of external factors can influence a glut of sales at a particular price point too. Sometimes it's just coincidence, but other times it might be a couple of towers releasing 1-bedroom apartments all at the same time and a big flood of settlements go through. Other times it could be a tax policy change. We've got, you know, a bunch of expats returning and selling very expensive family homes near Sydney Harbour. We've got lots of things that can skew data, and look at what government incentives for sub-$1 million or sub-$600,000 markets do. We had a rush of sales at a particular price point when we had incentives out there. So we absolutely have to be paying attention to the fact that no markets are equal, and there's an enormous breadth of of different types of dwellings and different price points in a lot of suburbs. But if you take a fringe suburb where you've only got house and land and you don't have apartments, you don't have units, you don't have, you know, large dwellings, then you might see, you know, a more homogenous array of sales results. So I think it's very important to look at long range, just as you said.
Dave, anything to add there?
Yeah, I agree. I see very little value in looking at capital growth rates over the short term, even anything less than a year, really. And I guess it boils down to why you're looking at those capital growth rates. So you're trying to sum up the approximate value of the property you're looking to buy. Are you ascertaining the supposed capital growth? Because 1 year is way too short a period of time to be looking at the performance of a suburb. You know, I think you need to look back. It's okay to look at what the results were year by year, but you want to look back 5 years, 10 years, as long as possible, really. So, yeah, it gets back to the purpose of why you're wanting to look at the capital growth figures. And as you said, Pete, 3 to 6 months isn't much value because of the distortion of the types of properties, the number of properties that are sold at any given time in any given location.
Do you remember, Pete, years ago when we'd go out and get those property magazines? I used to spend pocket money on them. And yeah, we'd go straight to the back of the magazine where they had, you know, all the two-font information about every single suburb, and you'd be looking for the massive gains, and you'd see some quarterly result like 42% in,
yeah, that's right,
you know,
yeah,
Mort Lake or, you know, tiny little Western Victorian township, and I'd get really excited and research it. But the problem was, if you've only had like 4 or 5 sales, who knows? You could be looking at last year, it was a few little cottage sales, and then this year you've got a few farms that have gone. Of course, it's going to show a really strong
increase. True. I do miss those magazines. We used to have, I reckon, 4 property magazines during the peak. I think the only
Australian
one that
exists Property now, Investor magazine, Your Investor.
Your Investment property, Smart Property Investor. But I think the only one that exists is Your Investment Property. And when I say exist, in paper form, hard copy. But I haven't been able to find a copy for ages. So it just takes a lot longer to do the research. Because if you did have that, the other questions he's asked here is, you know, are there any hard and fast rules regarding the growth of a suburb? You know, short-term growth, long-term growth. I mean, you could easily find that out by looking at, say, the back of the magazine. That assumes that you can find a magazine, or you could do it yourself. But that's the quantitative data. And I think some people focus too much on the numbers. And my argument is most property is not bought by the numbers. Most property is bought as a home. So there is something else other than the numbers that the market is looking at. So I also consider the qualitative research really important. You know, simple things like, has the quality of the area improved? Has the standard of cars improved in the area? Are people upgrading their homes? Has a wealthier demographic is more quantitative data. But there are some things that you can't determine from sitting at your computer. You have to get out there and have a look. So if you're looking for a number, you know, on average, again, it's shown that the Australian property market doubles every 10 years. So that means it compounds at 7% per annum. But that's nationally. Like Sydney doubled in 9 years. As we said before, Perth has just reached equilibrium in 8 years. So I'd hate to think how long it's taken to double. So it really does vary. But the point I'm trying to make is don't just focus on the numbers. If you're going to do your research on an area to invest in, please go and check it out, as well as crunching the numbers behind your desk. Please don't go away, because we've got our gold nuggets from Kate and Dave.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
Kate, what's your gold nugget?
Okay, my gold nugget is all about time in the market and measuring our gains, and I guess being patient and not trying to crystallise the gain by selling too soon. And it's easy for me to say that, but once you've got a property that's gone cash flow positive in your portfolio, it is easy to hold it unless you've got a burning need for those funds. Now, I've got a friend in the industry, Stuart at ProSolution, who put together a fantastic chart that I've used again and again and again, and I want to talk about it because he modelled out a simple investment, $500,000, that increases in value by 8% per annum. Now, that might for some seem a lofty goal, but the truth of this is that it's a consistent measure. Any property that increases in value by 8% per annum over a certain period of time, if it's an ongoing consistent increase, he broke it down into three blocks, and it was in 5-year blocks. So for the first 5 years of ownership of this property, the gain is $235,000. The second block, so from year 6 to year 10, the gain is $345,000. And for the last 5-year block, it's $507,000. Now, what he then did is looked at that 15-year period of returns and allocated a percentage of return to each 5-year block. So in other words, in the first 5 years, out of the 15-year total gain, it represented 21%. So you get 21% of your heavy lifting in the first third. In the middle third, 32%. But in that final 5 years where they held it from years 11 to years 15, they got 47% of their gain. My point is, the longer you can hold property, the better your returns get, and that's the beauty of compounding interest.
It certainly is.
Yeah, that's a great example, that how the capital growth and the percentage grow significantly over the long term as you hold property. Got exact same version in my ebook, How to Succeed with Property to Create Your Ideal Lifestyle.
Yeah, now the thing for us as investors is, once we reach that tipping point where it ticks over from requiring us to put money into it to turning cash flow neutral and then positive, yeah, you've got taxes and yeah, you've got maintenance, but your gains are growing and growing, and so is your rent.
Yeah, and the rent really starts to spit out cash, really, and that's the powerful thing of particularly a high capital growth asset, the rent grows at a faster rate over time.
So, Dave, are you just piggybacking on Kate here on her gold nugget, or you got your own, mate?
Well, just piggybacking for a little bit and then come into my own one. My gold nugget is buy as many properties as you can before you have kids. And start as early as you can. Look, the reality is cash flow is so much stronger, and, you know, we've got to live life and we spend a lot of it on the fun stuff prior to kids.
You just don't know what you don't know, though, do you? Everybody tells you that, but when they come along, you realise then just how expensive they are.
If we could only put our current old head on young shoulders, as they say. Yeah, so buy as many properties as you can prior to having kids, because for most people, 9 out of 10 people, the family home will end up becoming a priority, and that'll curtail so much of what was done. It might mean selling some properties or things having to be wound back. So, but it also can allow you to leapfrog into whatever you want to get into, particularly with that family home as well. So the more wealth you can create through property before having kids, before buying that family home, the better off you'll be.
Excellent.
Very good. That's a great one, Dave. Buy as many properties as you can as early as you can. If that's all we said after every podcast and people listen to that, mate, we'd probably be the best podcast in the country. Just before we go, again, now I've done two different things at the same time this episode. That, I mean, I'm on a roll here.
And we just think you're not listening to us.
I said before, Sydney had taken 9 years to double in price, right? Perth, 18 years to double in price. Yeah, just goes to show how important.
But the last time Perth doubled, it took like 2 minutes.
That's right. Just like that. Yeah, you got to take the good with the bad. Well, thank you very much, listeners, for your time this week, and we look forward to your company again next week. Bye for now.
Hi, it's Anne-Marie here. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about some of the themes discussed, take a listen to episodes number 4, How to Develop Your Own Property Plan. Episode 13, How Age and Stage of Life Can Impact Your Property Plan and Selection. Episode 22, Why the Family Home is Often the Biggest Piece of the Investment Puzzle. Episode 24, how mortgage strategy shapes your ability to hold property and how it can pay off for decades to come. Episode 33, starting without a plan and end goal. Number 3 of the top 7 critical mistakes.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bacos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.